The following Bible study is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
I want to talk about something that I've thought about for a number of years and just never was sure about the subject, and I think I'm ready to present it tonight. We'll talk a little bit about moons. I don't want everyone to panic, because we're not going to be changing the calendar. We're not going to be doing anything any different than we've really ever done before. The moon is a fascinating object. I'm going to read some statistics, so I hope you don't nod off, but to me, they're fascinating statistics. The moon is 225,700 miles from the Earth. It's 2,100 miles in diameter, 81 quintillion tons. The temperature during the day is 273 degrees, and it's kind of like Montana. The next night, it drops to 244 degrees below zero. That's an amazing difference, isn't it? The orbital speed around the Earth is 2,287 miles per hour, and the Earth is rotating about 1,000 miles per hour, like this. The moon is rotating, too, at about 10 miles an hour. It's an amazing thing, isn't it? So the moon isn't round. It's actually egg-shaped. But the part that extends out, the egg-like part, is actually facing us. And so we don't see the egg shape. We see it as round. And the widest crater is 140 miles in diameter. The deepest is 15,000 feet. The highest mountain, 16,000 feet. And the moon is moving away from the Earth at 1.5 inches per year. The surface area of the moon is phenomenal, 14,658,000 square miles. And it's interesting that the new moon is best seen to rise at sunrise. The first quarter appears at noon. The full moon rises about sunset, the last quarter at midnight. Kind of an interesting phenomenon. Orbits the Earth every 29.5 days. When the sun is behind the Earth, we see the full moon. When the sun is in front of the Earth, we can't see the moon. And let's go to Romans 1:20, if you will. But it's a beautiful thing, isn't it? The harvest moon, romantic. It's interesting that 12 men have walked the face of the moon. It's interesting, too, that our children will never know a time when mankind hasn't walked on the moon. It's a different world for them than it is in the horse and buggy days, for certain. So this movement accounts for the cycles of the moon, and I believe that there is a very real spiritual significance to these physical things that take place on the Earth. And so it says in Romans 1:20, the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that people who perhaps don't have the law, for example, are without excuse. So let's go to Genesis 1. The Bible says that there's something that we can learn from the creation. So what is it that we can learn from the moon? And then the question is, should we observe the new moon in the new covenant? You know, the scientists say that the moon came from the Earth. It's their view that some giant asteroid hit the Earth as it was cooling and knocked a chunk off, and that chunk solidified in the form of the moon, and and that piece solidified and became what is the moon today. The scriptures say that God placed the moon at a specific time in its location the way he did. Genesis 1 and verse 14. And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And he made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth and to rule over the day and over the night, to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was very good. And so it's clear to us that God created the sun and the moon and the stars. And they have an enormously important function in my mind. That is, they do more than just provide light on the earth during the day and during the night. The sun and moon create an astronomical calendar. And God said that they were for signs and for seasons. And as you remember, the Sabbath was to be a sign. And it's the same exact word. It's oweth in the Hebrew, O-W-T-H. And then for seasons, the word seasons is holy day observance or for assembly. And so you begin to see that God created these astronomical bodies and put them in the positions they're in for us to keep the holy days before he ever created a man. So for anybody who thinks that the holy days were done away at Sinai or were only given at Sinai and were done away, it would be foolish to think so, that they were there in God's mind and his intent for mankind before he ever created a man. So the sun and moon are set in the heavens by God for holy day observance, and the holy days foreshadow God's plan of salvation. Thus, the sun and moon, to me, are intimately associated with God's plan. They're connected, the invisible things of God. What are they showing us? What is the sun? What is the moon telling us who live on this earth? To me, there is enormous symbolism in the creation. Let's go to John 8. We're all familiar with this, how there is this duality in God's creation, that the things on the earth picture those things that are heavenly. So we are made in God's image, and we reflect God who is in heaven on the earth. The tabernacle was made after a pattern that was shown to Moses, and the pattern pictured God's throne. And the placement of each of the tribes and everything in that tabernacle had a specific location because it was reflecting something in heaven. So what about the sun and moon? Are those things reflecting something? The answer is yes. And I'm going to suggest tonight that the sun and moon are picturing in symbol Jesus Christ and his church. First, notice that the sun is a symbol of Jesus Christ. And God is light, right? And in him is no darkness at all. And Jesus is the light of the world. In John 8 it says, "Then spoke Jesus again to them, saying, I am the light of the world. He that follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life." And so the sun provides light in our world, if you go to Psalm 19. And in like manner, Jesus gives us the light spiritually from God. And so the sun is equated in Scripture to Jesus Christ. And in this next verse in Psalm 19, it's a beautiful verse, and it describes the sun as a bridegroom. And of course, that's what Jesus and how he's described in the Scriptures elsewhere. But notice Psalm 19. To the chief musician, in verse 1, a psalm of David. And David writes, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork." Yes, even his eternal Godhead, when we see the order that the universe is in, and we look at the sun and look at the moon. "Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night shows knowledge." So every day we're being taught something. Every day and every night. There's no speech or language, it says, where their voice is not heard. Their line goes throughout the earth, and their words to the end of the world. And so here's the sun and the moon sending a message, and that message goes out to the entire world. When it says their line, of course, it's a line like actors have lines on a stage. That is, their message goes out throughout the earth, their words to the end of the world. And in them he has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoices as a strong man to run a race. And his going forth is from the end of heaven and his circuit to the ends of it, and there's nothing hid from the heat thereof. That is the light. And so this beautiful picture is one of Jesus Christ coming from east to west, like the lightning or the sun. After the sunrise, Jesus comes, and he comes from east to west. And his light, when he comes, remember, a day is like 1,000 years, when he comes, his light will eventually fill the entire earth. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but let's go on to Revelation 1 and also in verse 14. So after Jesus was resurrected, he ascended to the Father, and he was glorified with the glory he had before. And in Revelation, it shows his glory. And it relates it to the Son. So we see this picture of Jesus is the light of the world, God is light, and then we see him as being compared to the Son as a bridegroom, and now we're going to see another picture of Jesus, his head in verse 14. And his hairs were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were as a flame of fire, and his feet like undefined brass, as if they burned in a furnace, and his voice is the sound of many waters. And he had in his right hand seven stars, and out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword. And his countenance, that is, the way his face looked, was like the sun shining in its strength. Let's go to Malachi 4. You ever looked at the sun? You kind of take a little blink. It's blind you, doesn't it, for a little bit. If you continue to look at the sun, what is it, 93 million miles away? You continue to look at the sun, and you will be blinded. It will burn your rods and cones in your eyes. It's so powerful, even that far away. And in Malachi, we see Jesus compared to this sun. Malachi 4 and verse 1, for behold, it says, the day comes that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yes, and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. And the day that comes shall burn them up, says the Lord of hosts, and it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Sun, S-U-N, of righteousness, arise with healing in his wings, and you'll go forth and grow up as calves in the stall. And so here's the Christ talking about the end time, him coming and burning things up. And remember when he came on Sinai, what happened to that mountain? Caught on fire, didn't it? The whole mountain, because of his presence. Now this spelling of sun is the original word is Shemesh, and it means brilliant or the sun. So we see this creation that pictures Christ every day. That is, a day, it says, is like 1,000 years. Christ comes in one day and brings his light to the earth. At the end of the day, there's a magnificent sunset, isn't there? And the sky looks like it's on fire. And so this picture is a day as 1,000 years, pictures Christ coming, his light filling the earth so that nothing can escape the light of God. And then at the end of that millennial kingdom, then there is a lake of fire that will burn everything up. And so the heavens preach the gospel. And it says the wrath of God before Romans 1:20 actually says the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. And we see that in this message that is being taught to us every day, a gospel message of a kingdom that's going to come in Psalm 19. So anyway, I want us today just to consider for a minute. Here's this being that looking at his face is like looking at the sun in his strength. Full strength. Remember how the scriptures say you can't look at God and live? That here is a being that is so powerful, so majestic, and his glory is such that he radiates out light and heat and energy. And he does it to such a degree that it talks in terms of the New Jerusalem, he and the Father being the light of it. And you have a building, this, an edifice that is 1,400 miles wide, deep, and high. So it is 1,300 miles higher than the satellites fly today. Imagine these beings that can light the entire edifice. I mean, how much power would it take? You know, understand, we have no dams that we could turn on. No electrical places today that could light an edifice of that size. We just don't have it, not one single one. Okay, it takes a lot of power. Here are beings that just by their magnificence. You understand, you've met people that have presence, haven't you? You can feel them when they're important people and they know what they're doing and they're in charge. You can just feel that. Imagine that as a type of the presence of God. That if you were in that presence, you would be burned up. Because I say that, I believe this anyway. It says that when he returns, the people are going to fight him. And then it gives this vision, doesn't it, of their skin just melting off their face and their tongues in their mouth and their eyes in their face. Well, what do you think's happening here? I believe that Jesus is just saying to those people, you want to fight me? Well, just to let you know who you're fighting, and he shows himself the way he really is. And they burn up. And that's what I think those scriptures are talking about. So you get the picture again. Christ is like the sun with this enormous power. So much power and glory. I mean, I just imagine that New Jerusalem. And I can, you know, the gold is different from our gold. Their gold in the kingdom, the spiritual gold, is transparent. And so you can imagine beautiful. It's like phenomenal light just radiating out, resplendent and shimmering through that edifice. And if it's 1,400 miles high, you could see it from hundreds of miles away. Everyone would know where headquarters was. They'd see the light of God just shining through the walls. Go to Psalm 136. It's interesting as we consider these things, how the sun and moon work together. That is, the sun has inherent light within itself. The moon has none of itself. It simply can reflect the light of the sun. And in a like manner, this then, I believe, pictures, the moon pictures, the church of God that reflects the light of God. But we don't always reflect it on the same level. Light is a picture and symbol of righteousness. But we have to reflect, and the only thing we can do is reflect the righteousness of Jesus Christ. And so, again, it is interesting how God made the earth and he made the sun to come every day, picturing this thousand-year reign of Christ and God's light filling the earth. And then he made the stars, and it says the moon, to rule the night. And the moon reflects the light of God during this time of the night. The night, of course, is dark. And darkness pictures iniquity, doesn't it? So you see the moon is connected with the earth, isn't it? It's not of the earth, but it's connected to it. It is of the earth. And you see the moon tied to the earth, and then you see the earth sunk in darkness today, and God's people being told they are to be lights in the world. And so you see this parallel as we reflect the light of God. We reflect the light of Jesus Christ as a body and as individuals. But the stars play a role in this too, because they also rule over the night. So let's go to Psalm 138, if you will. The stars play a symbolic role with the moon. Psalm 136, I'm sorry. The sun, it says, is to rule by day, for his mercy endures forever. The moon and stars are to rule by night, for his mercy endures forever. And so there's these fascinating parallels to look at. And remember how Abraham was told by God that his children would be like the stars for number. But remember that we're Abraham's children, aren't we? And we're grafted in, as it says, we're all Abraham. There isn't male or female, but we're all Abraham's children. And so we're going to shine like the stars, aren't we? God's people will. And it says that in 1 Corinthians 15. So there's these parallels. And Abraham gave birth to Isaac, a type of Christ. And Isaac gave birth to Jacob, and he had 12 sons. And these sons are also portrayed as stars. And let's go over to Genesis 37. We begin to see this in a dream that Joseph had that kind of caused him a little bit of a problem. So Christ is like the sun, and we're going to see here that God's people are going to be like stars. But in particular, there are going to be 12 stars, and the 12 stars represent the leadership within God's body or his church. So we begin to see this in a curious dream by Joseph in Genesis 37, where it says this, "And he dreamed yet another dream and told it to his brethren and said, Behold," in verse 9, "I've dreamed a dream more, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me." And he told it to his father and his brethren. And his father rebuked him, and he said unto him, "What is this dream that you've dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to you, to the earth?" And so they're a little offended by this, but you get the picture here. What do you see? Jacob, type of the sun. And you see his wife, a type of the moon. So you see the sun and the moon and 11 stars. Who's the 12th star? It's Joseph, isn't it? And so here's 12 stars, and here's the sun and the moon, and a woman is portrayed as the church in the Bible, isn't she? And so the woman here in the dream is portrayed as a moon, because there is this comparison. And we'll see this when we get to Revelation 12 and make a comparison with this dream, the sun and the moon and the stars, and Jerusalem above. So let's go to Psalm 104 from there. Jacob, a type of Christ, the sun and symbol, his wife, the moon, and the stars picturing the 12 chief rulers of Israel. Joseph is one of the stars, and the other 11 bow to him. You remember before that, he had another dream, and it was sheaves. And the sheaves, I think, represent harvest. We're talking about those in the first harvest. And I think there's some symbolism there. So in Psalm 104, it says this. The moon has a specific cycle. It goes through. He appointed the moon for seasons, and the sun knows it's going down. And so the moon is for seasons. Here we have the same word, modah, that is used in Genesis 1:14, that's talking about holy day observance and the assembly of God's people. And the dates for these assemblies are always determined by the moon, because the moon determines the month. And a woman in symbol is for the church. And I'm going to say something now. It's speculative, but it's interesting, isn't it, that the women are compared to the church. There's a comparison of the moon to the church. And women have a monthly cycle. And it's a fascinating thing to me that they wash away the seed, and their blood covers and washes away that which doesn't produce life. And it happens on a monthly basis. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the moon causes or determines what the month is. And the woman is a church in symbol. And I see these parallels. I'm not saying I understand every piece of them yet, but I think I have enough to say there's symbolism here of the sun and the moon. So let's take this now and move with it to Revelation 12. Revelation 12. There is this great connection with the church and the woman and then the moon. Revelation 12, 1, and there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. So here to me is a symbolic representation, a portrayal of Jerusalem above. Remember Galatians 4 and verse 26, Paul says, Jerusalem above is the mother of us all. And so here is a woman, and she is the mother of us all. And so it gives a scenario, and we'll read this a little bit later in more detail, of this woman gives birth to Jesus Christ, doesn't she? And she's clothed with the sun. That is, she is reflecting the light of Jesus Christ. And she's bathed with the righteousness of Christ. On her head, here is the crown of these 12 stars. And they're on a crown, and that's a symbol of rulership and leadership. And the 12 stars, of course, are not ancient Israel. Ancient Israel was a type that looked forward to spiritual Israel. Remember how Paul said that there is the Israel of God? They are not all Israel who are of Israel. No, we're grafted in, even if we're Gentiles, but we're grafted into what? Israel. And so we then become spiritual Israel, and that's why you see the 144,000 have the tribal names, because there is a spiritual Israel, and all that happened before was a type to teach us about this. So, again, we're going to see 12 stars, and they are going to represent leadership among the resurrected saints. Now look, she has the moon at her feet, doesn't she? Why is this? The moon is symbolic of the church on earth. She is in heaven above. And so she, of course, has a reflection of what she is at her feet. And so I make this connection. This is Jerusalem above, through which Christ was born. And then once he's on earth, then you hear it, the woman flees into the wilderness. And Satan tries to kill Christ. But here we have the Jerusalem above. She's the bride. She is the home of the 144,000, the ultimate destiny of God's first fruit, and she's related to the church on the earth. And so we see a relationship of the sun and the moon and the stars combined in her. And it's all, I think, pictured in this symbolism in Revelation 12 that corresponds to that symbolism of Joseph's dream. Joel 2. So we see the moon then, and begin to see a connection with the moon and the church, and how the church reflects the light of Christ, and where to be these lights in the world. Further, think about the symbolism in this. Here you have a moon that waxes and wanes, doesn't it? And so doesn't that picture the church? I mean, each era starts off, it's born anew, isn't it? And it grows and develops, and it does its work of preaching the gospel until it reaches its maximum success. And then what does it do? Then the church forgets, generally, its commission and forgets its calling, and it begins to wane, doesn't it? And then it disappears. And then another era begins. And 12 is the number of government. And that's what the church is all about, isn't it? God is training those who will govern. And that's why he has this pattern of 12, and why he has these waxing and waning of the moon. Now here's another reason you can know this is true. Because in the end of the age, we see changes that take place in the sun, and we see changes that take place in the moon, don't we? The moon is turned into blood, and the sun is darkened, and that's during the last days of the tribulation. And so here we have Joel 2 and verse 31, which says, "The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes." And so at the end of the tribulation, here's a time that's the worst time that mankind has ever experienced on the earth in the history of all mankind. And the truth of God will be stamped out by the beast's power, won't it? And there'll be darkness as far as God is concerned on the earth regarding the truth. It's going to be gone. So what happens symbolically? The sun goes dark because the sun is a type of Christ's light on the earth. Revelation 6. And verse 12, "And I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became blood." And so God's light can't shine in a world controlled by the beast power, and so there is no light of God on the earth anymore. And the sun goes dark to reflect that, because it's symbolically the light of God. And what about the church? The church is experiencing the worst persecution ever in the whole history of mankind. The church is bathed in blood from its martyrdom and persecution. And so what happens to the moon? It reflects what's going on in the church. And the moon becomes blood red. Now, there's some other symbolism in the moon that I'd like to discuss for a little bit. You know, we keep the holy days of God, and two of these sets of feasts are week-long feasts. And when we keep them on the 15th. And the 15th, that is the 15th of the first month and the 15th of the seventh month, the 15th is the time of the full moon, isn't it? Don't you see the symbolism there? Here God's people have a chance to come out of the world where we're not affected by our workmates and the pressures of finances and the pressures of troubles and problems and trials we have. We're able to come out of the world. We're able to come together and rejoice before God. And isn't that when we reflect the light of God more than any other time? It is, of course. And so isn't it appropriate that that's when the moon would be shining bright and full for us, reflecting this symbolism again? There's another thing that I think may be an interesting parallel. I'm not sure about this, but I'd ask you to give it some thought. There's a period where the moon actually waxes, where you can't see it anymore. And then it gets to the bottom, and it's a conjunction. And then it moves out of that, and then eventually a faint crescent appears. Do you know how long that period is? About 3 days. It's 3 days. And Jesus Christ is a part of the church, isn't it? You know what they call the conjunction? Another word for it is the head. They call it the head. It's the head of the month. But you understand my point. I'm looking at this. Is it possible? There's an analogy too, because Jesus Christ is a part of the church, isn't he? He's a part of it. So he would be reflected in the moon. And here we have the moon in a period where the head disappears into darkness for 3 days and three nights. Could it be reflecting that our Savior, the head of the church, died and was buried and saw darkness for 3 days and three nights? It's possible. I'm not sure. He came from Jerusalem above, just like we did. Let's look at Revelation 12:1 again. Revelation 12:1. It says this, "And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and with the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she, being with child, that is Christ, cried, travailing in birth and pained to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his head. And his tail drew a third part of the stars of heaven, and it had cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child who was to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne." And so Jesus came to the earth. The devil tried to destroy him, but he willingly gave his life, and he was dead for 3 days and three nights. Then he rose again. And that's what I say when the moon starts to come out. Is that a picture of his death and his resurrection that we see every single month? And then it was that Jesus sent the 12 apostles out after he ascended, and they will one day have positions on those 12 thrones, won't they? Judging over Israel, they will be the reflection of those stars. Numbers 28. So we see that 12 is the number of government, the number of the tribes of Israel, the number of the tribes of spiritual Israel. And thus we see the moon picturing the church has a 12-month year. And each month is determined by the moon, and it reflects these, I think, wonderful things. So I say this. God puts so much symbolism in the sun and in the moon that there's no question the pagans worshipped this stuff. I mean, you can imagine these were such important parts of their lives. But is there true meaning that is spiritual for us in these things? I say this. He puts so much symbolism into these things that picture us and our experience in life and our destiny. And if he did that, shouldn't we take note of it? And shouldn't we try to understand it? And then my question becomes, should we observe it? Should we observe the new moon? Did God, and so I'm going to ask this question, in the new covenant, and I want to talk to us a little bit about it tonight. Did God command us to keep a new moon anywhere in the Bible? No. You never see it, do you? And so some people would say, well, then therefore we don't have to keep it because God didn't command it. But you know what's interesting? That God did not command tithing in the Bible. He actually doesn't command it. Because it looks like, when you read the Bible, all he does is he talks about how it's to be administered with an understanding that the people already knew to tithe. They knew it from Abraham's time. They knew it from Jacob's time, didn't they? They knew about tithing. So when we see God bringing Israel out, he just tells them, here's how to administer it. You give a tenth to the priests, save a tenth. So he tells how to administer it. It's the same thing with the new moon. You see them observing it, and God actually dictates legislation about it, but he never says, you have to keep it, and here's how I want you to keep it. So it's kind of interesting. Let's follow this up in Numbers 28 and verse 11. In the beginning of your months you shall offer a burnt offering, he says, unto the Lord. 2 young bullocks and 1 young ram, 7 lambs of the first year without spot, and 3/10 deals of flour for a meat offering mingled with oil, 1 for a bullock, and two-tenth deals of flour for a meat offering mingled with oil. For one ram and a several-tenth deals of flour mingled with oil for a meat offering unto one lamb. For a burnt offering, a sweet savor. And it just keeps going like this. And it says at the end of 14, a burnt offering every month through the months of the year. And one kid of the goats for a sin offering unto the Lord in verse 15 shall be offered besides the continual burnt offering and drink offering. Psalm 81, if you will. But you understand what we're saying here. At the beginning of your months, that's the new moon, you shall offer a burnt offering unto the Lord. And so he's telling, he's legislating something regarding the new moon. But he doesn't say keep the new moon. He just, it's already being kept. And he's saying, this is what I want you to do on it. The psalmist reflects this practice that took place in Jerusalem in verse 2 of Psalm 81. Take a psalm and bring hither the timbrel, the pleasant harp with the psaltery. Blow up the trumpet in the new moon in the time appointed in our solemn feast day. For this is a statute for Israel and a law of the God of Jacob. So talk to Ben Faulkner today. He sends his love to everybody. He's the minister who serves the Sovereign Church of God. And he said he talked to a Hebrew expert. And I would say this psalm actually is speaking of the Feast of Trumpets, because it calls on the solemn feast day. But when he talked to a man who was an expert in Hebrew, that man told him, you can't be sure. The wording, the actual Hebrew words, could mean that you're to blow the trumpet on the new moon each month. Second Chronicles 2. So it could be the solemn feast day of trumpets, or it could just be every new moon. But Solomon kept the new moons, and he believed they were to be kept forever. Ever. And let's look at his writings here. Second Chronicles 2 and verse 3. Solomon sent to Hiram the king of Tyre, saying, as you did deal with David my father, and you sent him cedars to build him a house to dwell in, even so deal with me. Behold, I build a house in the name of the Lord my God, to dedicate it to him, to burn before him sweet incense, for a continual showbread, and for the burnt offerings, morning and evening, on the Sabbaths, and on the new moons, and on the solemn feasts of the Lord our God. This is an ordinance forever to Israel. So he thought that this should be done, something should be celebrated, these new moons. Okay, now I want us to consider a second point. And that point is this. We already observe the moon in several ways, don't we? The holy days are set according to the moon. So we're looking to the moon for guidance when we're going to keep any of these holy days. And we follow it as a spiritual reference point. We keep the new moon of the seventh month already, don't we? That's called a Sabbath. The other new moons are not, however. And we're commanded to keep it, and we do it. The full moon is the time when we have the week-long feast. And we always look up there, don't we? And we say, there's the full moon out there. So the moon is already connected to us fairly intimately. And my question would be, since we already use the moons as a part of our worship, why not note the new moon? Why not mark it and be aware of when it comes? A third point is this. The symbolism fits our experience. It's not something that was done away with the sacrifices, for example. It's like the holy days that foreshadow things to come. Because the moon demonstrates church eras with its waxing and waning, it is a gentle reminder, isn't it? It should be. That's the thing. See, it isn't, because we don't keep it. But it should be a gentle reminder that we need to renewal, and that we should renew ourselves. You see, when the moon is new and it's starting to reflect the light of God, symbolically, we should go, you know what, I should be doing that same thing, reflecting the light of God more and more. So it should be a time for renewal and recommitment every month. And I want to say this too. Let's go to Isaiah 66. Here's a fourth point. The same logic, to me, applies to the moon, new moons that we use for the holy days. So we tell people that the holy days were kept in the past. And we tell them they're going to be kept in the future when Christ comes back to rule. Why wouldn't we keep them now? They're going to be kept in the past, or were kept in the past, going to be kept in the future. Why would we abandon them now? Isaiah 66, will the new moons be kept in the future? The answer is yes. Isaiah 66:23 says this, it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, from one Sabbath to another, shall all flesh come to worship before me, says the Lord. And so from new moon to new moon, Sabbath to Sabbath, people are going to come and worship. And then we see that in Ezekiel, if you'll go to Ezekiel 46, in Ezekiel we see this incredible picture of a temple that is built. And the temple that is built, is we're given the dimensions of it and all kinds of details about it, and then we're told about how worship will be conducted and how it'll be used. And so in verse 1 it says this, thus says the Lord God, the gate of the inner court that looks towards the east shall be shut 6 working days, but on the Sabbath it shall be opened, and in the day of the new moons it shall be opened, and the prince shall enter by the way of the ports of that gate without, and shall stand in the post of the gate, and the priest shall prepare the burnt offerings and peace offerings and worship in the threshold of the gate. And then he shall go forth, but the gate shall not be shut until the evening. Likewise, the people of the land shall worship at the door of the gate before the Lord in the Sabbaths and in the new moons. And we see there's going to be the keeping, in one way or another, of worshiping God on the new moon. So we say they were kept in the past. They will be kept in the future. Why not keep them now? And so to me, why not apply that? Why not apply that now? And here's a fifth point, Nehemiah 10. Nehemiah 10, verse 31, and the people of the land, if they bring ware or any victual on the Sabbath day to sell, we agreed that we would not buy it of them on the Sabbath or the holy day, and that we would leave the seventh year in the exaction of every debt. Also, we made ordinances for us to charge ourselves yearly with a third part of a shekel for the service of the house of God, for the showbread, for the continual meat offerings, for the burnt offerings and Sabbaths, the new moons, for the set feasts, and for the holy things, and for the sin offerings to make atonement for Israel. Isn't that interesting? So we claim one, and if we do claim one and not the other, we're going to kind of look like, well, we're just picking and choosing what we want. And we could look like hypocrites for it. And I think we might be hypocrites, actually, if we did that. So, sixth point is this. And I'm not going to ask you to turn to these verses, but I'll just read them for you. God did so many things on a new moon. It's phenomenal when you think about it. So I'm going to read some of them. Genesis 8:5. The waters continued to abate until the 10th month, and in the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. Verse 13. In the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried off the earth. And so you see this first day of the month having a place to play. Exodus 40 and verse 2. On the first day of the first month, you shall erect the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. And so that's when they raised up the tabernacle. Moses was commanded after this to take a census of the people. God wanted him to do this. Numbers 1:1, the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness in Sinai in the tent of meeting on the first day of the second month in the second year after they'd come out of Egypt, saying, take a census of all the congregation of the people of Israel by clans and fathers' houses according to the number of names, every male head by head. Aaron died on the first day. And Aaron the priest went up in the Mount of Hor at the commandment of the Lord. See, God took him up there on the first day and died there in the 40th year after the children of Israel come out of the land of Egypt in the first day of the fifth month. Moses gave the law to the new people before entering the land. Remember, they went and they traveled for 40 years, and then they went into the promised land in Deuteronomy 1 and verse 3. And it came to pass on the 40th year, on the 11th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to all the Lord had given him in commandment unto them. And so he picks the first day of the month. They were ordered to cleanse the temple on the first day. They began on, this is 2 Chronicles 29:17. They began on the first day of the first month to sanctify it. On the eighth day of the month, they came to the porch of the Lord and sanctified the house of the Lord in 8 days. Colossians 2, if you will. Ezra left for Babylon on the first day of the month. He arrived in Jerusalem on the first day of another month. Ezra 7 and verse 9. For on the first day of the first month began he to go up from Babylon, and on the first day of the fifth month He came to Jerusalem. Ezra 10, when it came to the issue of foreign wives, they decided what to do. They had a meeting on this, and they decided what to do in the first month. Children of the captivity did so, and Ezra the priest, with certain chief of the fathers after the house of their fathers, and all of them by their names were separated and sat down on the first day of the 10th month. Ezekiel 26:1 came to pass in the 11th year, on the first day of the month, that the word of the Lord came to me, saying, 29:17, and it came to pass in the 27th year, in the first month, and the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Ezekiel 31:1, and it came to pass in the 11th year, on the third month, in the first day of the month, that the word of the Lord came to me, saying, and it came to pass on the 12th year, on the 12th month, in the first day of the month, that the word of the Lord came to me, saying, and Haggai 1:1, in the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, saying, you know what I'm thinking? If we got closer to God, if we were there on the first day of the first month, he might speak to us. He might inspire us, because he's doing an awful lot of that here to these people. So you see what I'm getting at. God puts a spiritual value on the new moon. Should we? Should we? Has been a question I've wanted to know for years. Should we honor God? And would we honor God by honoring that day? Here's the seventh point. Colossians 2. Colossians 2. We're fairly familiar with this scripture where it says, let no man judge you in meat or in drink or in regard to a holy day or the new moon or the Sabbath, which are a shadow of things to come. And so right there, the Sabbath is a shadow of things to come, isn't it? The holy days are a shadow of things to come, aren't they? And the new moon is a shadow of things to come. It is symbolically foreshadowing events. The Colossians were being condemned by the Gnostics. Remember, the Gnostics had two kinds of sects. One were the Epicureans that believed you could do anything you wanted and enjoy all the pleasures of life, no matter how depraved they were, as long as you had love in your heart. Didn't matter. And the other ones were the Stoics, and they believed, they were ascetic, and they believed that you should, because physical was evil, you shouldn't have anything to do with it, and they were in the other extreme. And these are the kind of Gnostics who were in Colossae, and these people were, by the way, Colossae was a Gentile community. It was not one filled with Jews, and most of your books and commentaries will tell you this. So what happened is, here's these people, they found the truth, they're now following God, they're rejoicing, they're partying at the feast, and these Gnostics are saying, man, that's depraved and wrong, and you shouldn't do this. And so Paul's saying, don't let them judge you in your keeping of holy days and new moons and Sabbaths, because they're foreshadowing things to come. Some say the new moon is trumpets, you see. And so that way they think that new moons don't apply because it doesn't have an S on it. But see, it talks about the feast days as separate from, and God includes, doesn't he? You notice in Leviticus 23, there is no mention at all of new moon, is there? But it mentions trumpets. So trumpets isn't considered a new moon to God in the same way that the new moons are. So I'm suggesting to you, this is evidence to me. Exodus 40, suppose we were going to keep the new moon, how would we keep it? How is it to be kept? See, there's absolutely no place in the Bible that commands us to keep it, and there's no place in the Bible that tells us how to keep it, how to observe it. No set way, no command not to work. It's not a holy day. It's not a Sabbath day. In fact, work was done on this day. And I'll go back to Exodus 40. In verse 1 it says, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, on the first day of the first month shall you set up the tabernacle of the tent of the congregation. Can you imagine if it was a Sabbath? He wouldn't be telling them, okay, set it all up. He would not do that. So this means that it's okay to work on a new moon, doesn't it? It's not a sin to do that. And so we can observe the new moon and still not lose our jobs. And there's no command to assemble, is there? There is no command to assemble. And so, thus, it's not like we have to keep it like we keep holy days, because it's not a holy day. But more rather, I think, you mark it, that is, you observe it. We have not observed it. We don't count the days, do we, to Pentecost. We don't observe the new moon. And God says to count, doesn't he? We should probably, at least I would like to do this. I talked to Mr. Faulkner today, and you know what he does? When he has a Bible study, and they have snacks and so on the new moon, and the brethren come, and what he does is he reads everything that happened in the Bible that month. That's kind of an interesting idea, isn't it? Some of the events in the Bible that happened on that month. Because we don't even know which month we're in, do we? Because we're not paying a bit of attention. Because we think it doesn't matter. But it must matter for him to put something that size up in space and set it all up so it reflects everything the way it does. I think we should care about it, at least. So, my point is, we wouldn't keep it like a holy day or anything like that. But I would ask us, I think we should focus on the meaning of the day. I think we should focus on how much light of God are we reflecting in our lives. How much are we displaying? And on another level, it is a time of renewal, and it should remind us every month, oh yeah, I need to start reflecting the light of God more than I have. So for all of these reasons, I would like to suggest that the ECOG should acknowledge this day. I would like to hold a Bible study on the new moon. Attendance shouldn't be required, and you don't have to keep a Sabbath or anything like that. But I think it would be a good time, if I've always thought we should have some Bible studies, and you'll see that my Bible studies are different from my sermons. You'll see I'm going to go into a lot more depth, and you're going to learn a lot more about the Bible. And so we want to start Bible studies, and why not do it on that day? Why not just have a Bible study on the new moon and perhaps talk a little bit about some of the things that happened on that day, as Mr. Faulkner does, and why not enjoy some snacks and fellowship? And I think in that way we could honor God more than we have been, and I think we could learn some things. And at the same time, we wouldn't become obsessed with moons and obsessed with having, you know, to keep the new moon. But we would just simply quietly be noting it. As one other person says, marking it is all we'd be doing. And so I'm suggesting this is not radical. I'm suggesting that it is one more little facet of the truth that we could polish a little bit and see a little bit more clearly into the plan of God. So Mr. Armstrong kept the holy days for 7 years, not knowing what they meant for most of that time. And then it was revealed to him. And I think that, you know, things have been revealed to us. And I think this is one of them. And in balance, I think we can do this and honor God and not get quirky and weird or Jewish or any of that. So anyway, it's my hope that this will, and my belief, that we will be able to further honor God by this practice.